right, everybody, we're back. Knocktown Radio, coming at you from Skid Row Studios. I'm Rich, and we've got Crail here.
Yes, sir.
And just want to let you know, we are live, and you can call the show at 1-800-893-9562, or you can hit us up on Facebook. And Crail,
yes,
tell
sir.
Everybody who we have in studio with us tonight.
Man, we got double trouble in the studio today for you guys. We got a guy that's been around the industry a long time, pretty much well known in the industry of geese and martial arts. We got Howard Liu of Howard Combat Kimonos in the house. And we also got Chad Weigel of Boxy Science USA, who's probably been coaching people how to box for 15, 20 years. How many years over there?
20 years.
All right, man. I just want to say welcome to the show, guys.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, guys.
All right, let me get my applause going here. Hold on. A little laugh. Whoa, what's that?
Oh, okay.
Yay. All right.
A little word from our in-studio audience, as always. Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I got laughs, too.
Oh, you guys are too kind. Well, everybody, we're bringing you both sides of the sports today, boxing and jiu-jitsu together. And usually we kind of cover one or the other, but tonight we have two points of view on the subject. And, you know, where to start, Crail? We got so much.
Yeah, it's actually pretty cool because Howard, I'm sure Howard's been telling you, he's probably been in the mixed martial arts science for a long time. So maybe if you care to just enlighten us in the crowd a little bit about yourself, Howard, and then we'll jump over to Chad, if that's okay.
Sure. I started doing this in 1993 out of a self-defense class at a community college. And the guy that was teaching it was he was a karate guy, and he was started doing jiu-jitsu in the class. And I fell in love with it. And I would train with him after class, and this was January of 93, and I was hooked from that first day. And he was a white belt with the Machado brothers, and I did jiu-jitsu with him at the community college for about a year. And then in 1994, I went from there straight over to the Machado Academy in Redondo Beach, and my formal jiu-jitsu training began there.
Yeah, is it in the same place it was, his academy?
No. It was it was really off of PCH and I don't remember exactly, but it was closer to the beach area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I know it probably wasn't. It wasn't as big as it is now. You can drive down the street, you know, five, six academies nowadays.
But yeah.
So yeah. Back then it must have been pretty different.
Well, back then it was just the Gracie Academy and the Machado Academy there.
Okay.
Yeah, over in the South Bay.
Yeah. I think you said it was actually was before UFC 1, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because UFC 1 was in November of 1993.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And so karate, and so really like you were saying before, that was then, at the time, a real mixed martial arts academy you were training at.
No, they were a traditional sports jiu-jitsu academy. I didn't venture on over into mixed martial arts until the year 2000. So I was at the Machados from 94 to about the year 2000. And that's when I made the jump over to mixed martial arts.
And, you know, back then, at what point did you see, you know, a market for you to start, you know, in production for your gi company?
Well, you know, it was actually done. It was actually an accident. I loved the sport so much when I started. You know, you fall in love with it right away. I mean, like both you guys. You know, it's like instant crack. You know, yeah. You have to have it all the time. And the gis they had back then were just really poorly made gis. Or at least the ones that we were exposed to. And I actually tore 3 gis in 6 months.
Wow.
And I said, you know, if I'm going to continue doing this sport, man, I can't keep buying gis. And so I had a quest to look for a really good gi, and I would just keep looking for it, and nobody had them. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, I started seeing guys coming in to the academy from Brazil. They have these really nice gis, like these Krugens gis,
yeah,
and these Toro gis, and we're, wow, everybody wants one of those. But couldn't find them. But the ones that were available, you know, they bring them up from Brazil in their suitcase, and they're asking like $200 each for them.
Wow! Oh, like the going rates now.
Yeah. Exactly.
Before then, import duty.
Yeah,
right?
and then I started looking around, and I, you know, as you get into the sport, you kind of or your eyes open up and you see other things. And, you know, I noticed that there was a, you know, the sport which was related to judo, and in the town that I live in, there's a community center, Japanese community center, where they offer judo. Mm-hmm. So I went over to the community center and, mm-hmm. and talked to the judo people, and I said, you know, I said I really wasn't interested in joining, but I asked, you know, do you sell gis here? And they said, oh yeah, you know, we sell gis. This is like in what, 95?
Where was this at, around here?
Yeah, it was in Gardena.
Oh, Gardena, okay.
Yeah, Gardena, California.
Because I know earlier, I mean, just a little off topic, you were saying you grew up here in L.A.
Yeah. I grew up in downtown L.A., and then I moved to Gardena several years ago. And they had these judo gis, made these Japanese gis called Mizuno.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mizuno, okay.
Okay, and so they ordered me their cheapest gi. It was $75. And when I got it, I said, oh my God, I said, these are fantastic looking gis. These are really well made. And then I bought another Mizuno gi, which is a little higher up. And that was like a $125 gi. And, that's what I would wear to jujitsu, but they were judo gis. And, but what I wanted was a jujitsu gi. So, I took those Mizuno gis and I actually went to a seamstress and had her alter them to a jiu-jitsu cut.
Right.
And then after that, I just kept thinking, you know, gosh, I wish someone would make a really nice jiu-jitsu gi with Japanese style construction, because, you know, you would marry the two together, really high-end gi with, you know, that'd be fitting for a sport. And I kept, you know, talking to myself about it, talking to a couple of guys at the academy about it, and mainly just get something good for myself. And, lo and behold, I end up in a trip to China in 1996. So, you know, I have all these weirdo clothing designs in my head. And the trip was going to end in Hong Kong. And I've been to Hong Kong before, on business before, so I knew you could have anything made
there.
Yeah.
I guess some shirts made there.
Yeah.
I mean, they do them real quick. Like,
and they're the best shirts.
Yeah.
And they're the best fit, right?
Yeah.
Best fit, and, you know, and the material is superb, right?
Well, you know, what's funny is, everyone always makes fun of me because at work I wear dress shirts that have my name and stuff embroidered on the sleeve, but they're from Hong Kong.
Right.
And they make you a custom shirt cheaper than I can buy one here.
Yeah. So. Right.
And well, for people that don't know, can you explain real quick some of the big differences between a judo gi and a jiu-jitsu gi?
Okay.
Or at least the biggest differences?
Fit. Mm-hmm. That's the only difference between a judo gi and a jiu-jitsu gi. Judo gis are cut and measured to meet the requirements of the IJF, with the International Judo Federation. Okay. And the jiu-jitsu gis are cut and measured to meet the requirements of the IBJJF. The requirements in judo are the sleeves have to be a certain width, the length has to be a certain width, the crossover from the torso have to be have to touch a certain way as well, and that's why they're cut the way they're cut. The requirements for jiu-jitsu, they allow for a more tailored fit. So if you entered in a national judo tournament, you will not be allowed to wear a jiu-jitsu gi because they don't meet their measurement requirements. Whereas in a national tournament in jiu-jitsu, you could wear a judo gi because it exceeds their measurement requirements.
Right. I know, like, now when you go to a tournament, the IBJJF, typically they'll run the measuring tool through your jiu-jitsu gi.
Right.
But was that always prevalent back then when you first started making gis?
Not really. The old rules were the old rules were the forefinger in the sleeve.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And if you had really tight cigarette sleeves like all the gis were, you would kind of fold your fingers from four to two and slip them in there. So there was a lot of there was a lot of tailoring going on back then.
Yeah, I know there's been a lot of changes, and IBJJF has been, they've been really strict on their gi requirements, and even now I think they said like no more rip stop, and you know they're changing things around, and
well, you know, I think they're trying to follow how judo is, which is a structure, you know judo's been around for a long time, and you know, jiu-jitsu here in America is probably just starting getting into its pre-teen years.
Right.
So, you know, it's still a growing sport.
Yeah. Is a judo, is that an Olympic sport?
Absolutely.
So it's internationally structured. It has to have that. Yeah, that's awesome.
That's a good point, because I know they keep pushing to try to get Brazilian jiu-jitsu as an Olympic sport as well. So I can see how they'd want to structure that so it fits the same mold as judo.
Right. Right.
And I guess the same goes for probably karate or taekwondo that's in the Olympics as well.
Well, taekwondo is in the Olympics, but karate isn't.
That's why I have such an appreciation for the boxings and the wrestlings when it comes to MMA, because the people who have studied those, that's in an internationally structured sport, so they know what competition is all about. They know how to deal with referees at all different levels. So it's good.
Yeah.
And so when you were in China, you were you had your designs, you know, ready with you, and then is that where you like went into production? Or
What it was when we ended up in Hong Kong, we had about 2-3 days left in our trip, and so I was, you know, I actually went looking for some factories, but the intent still was not to make to sell. It was to build something for myself, kind of like how what Krail talks about having his custom made shirts in Hong Kong. Well, I wanted a custom made D for myself. I didn't care about, you know, if I was going to bring one for everybody else in my dojo. That was not the intention. And so Hong Kong is a small place, and so you can get around real easily. And I went to about 5 or 6 different factories, and then I struck pay dirt. I found the factory that sells for Mizuno and Adidas.
That's kind of crazy.
I found the high end.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, basically. And so, I went there and I told those guys about what I wanted to do. And, you know, them being in the martial arts, you know, they have a basic understanding, but they're very familiar with judo, manufacturing judo gis.
Yeah. Was this not like 95, you think? What year was it?
96.
96. Okay.
96. It was like April of 96.
Okay.
And then, I told them that, you know, what the little specifications were for what I wanted in the jiu-jitsu. And they said, well, you know, it's close enough to what they do in judo, so they could go ahead and make me a sample or two.
Right.
So, you know, we exchanged information, came back home. About 2 weeks later, when I got home, you know, well, here's the sample.
Wow, that quick, huh?
Oh, yeah. And but it wasn't exactly like what I wanted. It was... they still weren't sure of the actual measurements. And so for them to be safe, they stay closer to, judo specifications.
Right. I would assume that for them it was something new. Like, hey, why does this guy want to show, you know, this sleeve so short? Right.
Right.
They'd be like, something's wrong here.
Yeah. And then so we went back and forth, and until they finally got it right. And then when they got it right, I said, great, I want to order 30 suits for myself.
And they go, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Just for a second. And then they tell me, they go, well, you're crazy.
Yeah.
I go, what do you mean? 30 suits. We don't do business with you. Your minimum order is 300 suits. I go, okay. You know?
Yeah.
I go, 300. I said, you're crazy. And they go, well, you like what we do. We have the reputation. You know, we manufacture for these two brands that show up in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, they were telling me they're serious people.
Yeah.
And they delivered a serious gi to me. And I said, and if I wanted it, I had to play by their rules.
Wow.
So my first order was, well, you know,
So now you got a closet with 290 extra gis.
More than a closet.
No, actually, I was going to give up the idea.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, some money fell in my lap. Prior to business deal, right, that someone owed me some money, and they said, oh, hey, you know, here's my debt, it's paid. And so I had this excess cash to either save, put in the bank and save it, or to spend it.
Uh-huh.
You know, because it was.
So I guess from there, was that where
so
your
plan
changed?
Yeah. So
okay.
Yeah. So
sorry.
So I took that money and I bought the 300 geese. And then of course, you know, I'm not stupid. I'm not gonna buy 300 geese my own size, right? Because I have to get rid of them. And so I made like, I think it was like Now, see, back then, see, I use a different sizing than numbers than the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. They use like A1, A2, A3.
Right.
I use the traditional universal system of measurements for martial arts. So let's say an A1 would be a size 3.
Right.
International. An A2 would be a size 4, and an A3 would be a size 5.
Okay.
You know, like if you walked into any martial arts store or every country store in the world, and you say, hey, you know, I want to buy a size 5 karate gi, they know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
But if they said, I want an A3 karate gi, they'll give you a funny look.
Yeah.
You know, because they, you know, that Brazilian system is just kind of to themselves.
Right.
Which is okay. You know, but.
Yeah. And I do notice that your sizes also allow for different pants or different height people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because sometimes you look at the spread of like an A2 and it's like from 5'5 to 6'2. Right, you're like, wow, someone's going to be wearing some high waters.
That was a very smart idea to make your gi, you know, able to be marketed in other countries and other places.
Yeah,
and
right.
There isn't going to be any confusion, you know, in what sizing this
right.
is. That was a very, very good idea.
Well, you see, but at that time, I didn't know if, you know, I didn't know where it was really going. And so, anyways, so I put the money down, waited 4 months for the production to come in. They came in, and there you are in my house, you know.
Yeah.
You know, all these boxes in my house, what am I going to do with all these? And then, so I brought a couple of geese into the Machado Academy where I trained at, and boy, they snapped them up. And in about 6 weeks, I sold out 300 geese.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
This is before the internet.
Yeah.
That's what's crazy, though. Yeah. Like,
it's like crack. It really is.
Yeah. You know, like now we can go online and be like, oh, I'm going to look up what the geese are. Yeah. But like back then, it was really a small community, word of mouth and stuff, right?
And so by the way, I brought you two. Some Howard geese.
Oh, wow. Oh, excellent. Right. Oh, wait, let me get my claps out.
There,
oh,
look at that.
All right. This is for Krill.
Oh, thank you.
And this is for Rich. I hope it fits Rich.
Oh, thank you.
There you go, man.
Wow, thank you. Excellent. You guys can't see, really, but we got a Howard Kamba kimono gi.
Yeah, and after the show, we will post some pictures on our Facebook page so you can take a look at these geese.
I'm going to choke Richard out with the
Boy, hold it up. Here comes Jeremy with the camera.
Oh, yeah.
Look at that.
Jeremy.
Oh, wow. That was like Christmas time in here.
Yeah.
This is really
thank you.
Yeah. See, and Creo, you wear a mixed size. I brought you a 5 jacket with 4 pants.
Oh, so, excellent.
You know?
It's awesome, and I love white geese.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
well, you can't wear anything but white and blue now.
What about black?
You can't wear black.
Who says that?
IBJJF.
When did that happen?
Just this year.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I think the rules have changed.
They were saying it was a lot of eye strain for the referees.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah. Hmm. I think they started off with black belts only now, but I believe they were trying to do it to avoid the referees having eye strain. That's what they said.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows?
Hey, but thank you very much.
Yeah, oh, you're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Can't wait to try it on.
God, dude, give him a sticker or something. We got to give him something back. We're all lonely over here. We can get him nothing back. It's like a bad Christmas.
If you missed the picture, definitely before the show is over, we're gonna give everybody Howard's info where you can check out and buy your own gi too.
Oh, yeah. Thanks a lot. Man.
Yeah, and I mean, you go on there now. I mean, you can tell them now. They go on there now. What is it?
www.howardlu. That's howardlu.com.
Yeah, I mean, and there you go on there, and the prices. I was like, wow. And I thought that was an error in pricing on there, but it's competitive. It's a good price.
Thank you.
You know, it's priced where everybody, you know, can pick up a gi. And even if you're starting out, a lot of times, you know, you don't want to make a huge investment. You just started training. Yeah. And, you know, it's just important to get the right equipment. But definitely, if it's affordable, that is, you know, is even better.
Yeah.
Are those the same prices from the 90s?
No, but actually prices have gone up because of
cotton.
You know, there was a drought in 2009 in Pakistan, and 2010 there was a drought in China. So there was a lot of speculation in cotton futures, and boy, the price of cotton went up over 1,000%. And according to the Wall Street Journal at that time, it was the highest it had ever been since the Civil War.
That's crazy.
And the thing is, you don't really see the true effect of cotton prices immediately because of speculation, you know, because brokers buy everything and then they actually set future pricing.
Right.
So, we're going to see high prices in cotton for at least another year, year and a half, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, but I think that's also good information because sometimes people just think that the prices of geese are just going up because
people are
greedy. Yes. And there might be a couple of people out there that are greedy trying to make more money on their geese, but really, cotton's expensive.
It is now.
Well, too, yeah. I guess maybe sometimes, you know, the prices of geese are going up and changing because of just, I guess, you know, graphics and other fancy things people are doing to their geese now and, you know, mm-hmm. designs and stuff.
That's part of it.
Yeah. What would you say from the original design? I know sizes have changed. Has there been a lot of changes in the style of your geese or since the beginning, or have they pretty much stayed you know, true to what they were?
Well, no, they stay true because I really look at the market differently than what it is. Maybe it's because I am old. I really look at it as equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're going to be doing something, you might as well have the best equipment that you can possibly have. You know, I really didn't look at it as fashion.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, you know, durability is going to be a real big thing, especially, I mean, everyone knows what kind of stress the jiu-jitsu gi is under.
Well, yeah, and you know, and that's what my reputation is that my gis last forever. You know. And in fact, here's an interesting story, I got to tell you. You know, my original factory, you know, sold for Mizuno and sold for Adidas, but I don't know if people really know that the original Jean-Jacques Machado signature gi by Adidas is actually my design.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. The factory gave Adidas my designs.
Oh, wow.
That's not well.
But that's what it was. And then the wow. template for the Hicks and Gracie Mizuno gi was based off of my template.
That's right. Well, so what happened with that? You let them do that or they just did
what
that?
Can you do?
Yeah, I guess nothing, right?
Nothing. Now, you know, the Hicks and Gracie gi is slightly different with the backset sugi, which makes it a little bit different than mine. But if you look at it and if you kind of look at the templates, how it's structured, it's awfully, awfully close to mine.
Yeah.
And so after that original batch of 300 gis that went, how'd you feel like, you know, after that? Were you just ready to jump back in and go into full production or?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I caught the bug.
When you really started to put in effect, where were you marketing most of your geese? Were you going to tournaments or how were you getting the word out back then?
Pretty much at tournaments and actually, I had a internet commercial website, late 1996. So I was on there early.
You were, okay.
Yeah, on there early. And, back then how you got, in addition to local word of mouth, how you got, known was, through these, I think they used to call them electronic bulletin boards.
Okay.
You know, these little internet forums.
Yeah.
And that's how I got my name out there. You know, I became part of that community.
Just a reputation of having a good product. You know,
thank you.
Imagine, you know, that's going to keep you, you know, going for this many years.
Well, yeah.
Well, I also think, you know, and we talked about this earlier, but also John Iwano, who we had as a guest, he actually, if you go back and listen to our show, he actually says that you were the one person that helped him start his company.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, like, he even said it, you can check out the previous podcast, probably like our second or third podcast.
Well, we were just talking about it yesterday, actually.
And he was like, you know, Howard Liu told me, here's what you do, here's where you go. And I was just like, wow, to me, I was like, you don't find those kind of people nowadays, because most people are very secretive about stuff, right? Even though you can get everything on the internet or try at least. But
well, you know, back then the community was a lot smaller, and we really looked at it as a real brotherhood because it was so small. And how I met John was actually at a backyard fight.
Was he fighting or what?
No. It was an event called Neutral Grounds.
And who else? Well, you told us someone else you met there too. Who else did you meet there at that
same event? Savant Young.
Yeah.
He was a competitor at that event, Neutral Grounds. So a lot of big names came from that event. Rico Rodriguez, Dean Lister, Francisco Bueno. I don't know if you remember that name.
Yeah.
Francisco Bueno.
I thought that dude had a had a school like in Bellflower or something.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah, way back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he fought in front. He got knocked out by Igor Volchanchin.
Oh, know? Wow.
Yes, but they all started there at Neutral Grounds.
Where was that at?
It was on
someone's backyard.
Yeah, it was. No, Normandy and 228th. In fact, John Iwano had a couple guys competing in that event. One of them was Javi Vasquez.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Mr. Showtime. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. And that's how I met John. John's a terrific guy. And, he came up to me and goes, hey, you know, he goes, I'm thinking about getting into the gi business. What do you think? I said, go for it, John. I said, you know, this is, do it.
Yeah.
You know, I said, more the merrier. And he goes, you don't feel bad about that? I said, hey, wait a minute. Look, you look at commerce here in America. You'll have Burger King on one corner, Taco Bell across the street, McDonald's and Carl's, all in the same intersection.
No Starbucks back in the 90s.
No. No, right? But the thing is, you know,
yeah.
Competition breeds success. Breeds, yeah. You know, so I think it's bad if you have a monopoly.
Yeah.
Well, like I said before, Tiago, you know, everybody, you know, everyone I know that trains don't, you know, has more than one gi.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, all of it. We have more than one gi, and it's good, you know, try out a different brand once in a while.
Oh, I encourage stuff.
Yeah.
You
know, until you find the one you like. Everyone has their, you know, their different gis for kind of their different purposes. Yeah. You know, your heavy duty training gi that you know that it's not going to rip, or your light competition gi and stuff. So it's good to have a selection.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Neutral Grounds, huh?
Yeah, Neutral Grounds. Ryan Chenoweth.
That's pretty.
He's on Facebook. Check him out.
Okay. Ryan Chenoweth. I've actually seen him, yeah. Well, shout out to Savant, because I know next week he's got Proving Ground 7.
Yeah, we're going to be there.
Yeah, so he's got his own set of fights at his academy in Pasadena called Proving Ground 7. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for those of you listening, we're going to be there. You want to come down, hang out with us here at... you know, from Mad Time Radio, we're going to be out at Savant's place.
Yeah.
If you need to find us, Richard will be wearing his Howard Comeback kimono there.
Right.
Yeah.
I'll be modeling that.
Yeah. But you know, but I'm not just totally involved with the jiu-jitsu world either. I have a foot in mixed martial arts too. I was very lucky to become Randy Couture's short sponsor for many years.
Yeah, back in the day. Good old Randy.
Yeah.
And how did you two meet?
Through Rico Ciparelli, my wrestling coach and my mentor. He's he was head of the Raw team. Met Rico Ciparelli through a guy named John Donahue, who was a referee for the Extreme Fighting Challenge. And John Donahue was a blue belt at the Machados.
Okay.
And that's what I was training at. And he introduced me to Rico, and Rico introduced me to the Raw team, and we've been together ever since.
And so in your training, did your training ever evolve into mixed martial arts as well, or did you just stick to training jiu-jitsu?
Oh, no. I switched over to mixed martial arts in 2000. So, you know, I trained at then called the Raw Training Center, which Rico Ciparelli was the owner. He's a world-class wrestling wrestler, you know, he had a stable of UFC fighters in his gym, and I got thrown into the mix.
And how'd you and Chad meet?
At the Raw Training Center. He was brought in as the boxing coach.
Okay.
Around 2005.
So how long have you been boxing for, Chad? Did you box or did you just coach?
I boxed a little bit. So I grew up in Canada, where it's more amateur based than it is professional based.
Okay.
And when I was 18, grew up in a little town, and I walked into the boxing gym, and I boxed for a few months, got some competitions in, but I really wanted to coach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, like, I didn't know it then, but now I realize that my God's gift is to teach. If I know the fundamentals of something, I can teach it. Why me as a young man picked boxing, I have no idea. But it's got me through traveling around, met Howard, got me to L.A., working at the R1 gym. So it's good.
Is that where you're at now?
Yeah. I'm the boxing coach over at the R1 gym.
Okay, where's that gym at?
South Englewood.
Okay.
Yeah, right in Prairie and Imperial.
Prairie and Imperial, right by the is there a mortuary or a funeral place right there, isn't there?
Oh, I'm sure there's probably a few funerals.
It's
the Prairie exit off of the 105.
Yeah.
10 minutes from the LAX.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of the guys you've trained in the past. I know there was a couple of big names that came up when we were talking about some of the people you had worked with before.
Well, because I was a boxing guy, right? And I had no idea about, like, I liked watching MMA, you know, on TV and stuff. But So I came into the R1 gym, and I'm training this guy who I guess is a pro. And like we were talking about earlier, is that I didn't know who he was until I'm flying with him over to Hawaii for this show called Rumble in the Rock. And people are coming up to this guy asking for autographs. I'm like, who is this guy? Yeah. I still didn't know until I got back. I researched a little bit. And his name is Frank Trigg. And so he was part of the Raw team, or the R1 team. So
he's based out of El Segundo, right?
Well, that's where
the original gym was.
But, oh, it was. Okay. Yeah, okay.
And then recently moved
to Inglewood.
Okay. His cauliflower ear didn't give any clues that he was somebody?
No.
I've
been around long enough to know that doesn't mean anything.
No. You probably slammed in the door. Rich was saying that people would slam their ears in the door to get cauliflower.
I heard people in Brazil, the guys put their ears in doors.
Really? Yeah. Ooh, boy. Wow. Ooh, not me.
No.
So they won't get beat up on the beach.
There you go. There you go.
So during that time, Chad, or tell us how you came, how BoxingScienceUSA.com came about.
Well, so that's a recent company that myself and a couple of friends of mine, we partnered up to do, because one, we over the past 20 years, I've noticed that boxing is a really good fix-it for young men in particular. But I mean, it's good for everybody. So what I noticed is that moms all across the world, I'm sure, knock on a boxing room or on a boxing gym door asking for, you know, guidance for the young man because they don't have someone, like a strong male figure in their life. And so, but boxing has such a bad rep that it gets lost in the community level because people think it's professional and people are going to get hurt, kids are going to get hurt. But really, it's so good to learn confidence, discipline, and all that kind of stuff that you get from a lot of combat sports because it's an individual sport.
Right. Well, I noticed in my own personal experience is in going to, you know, boxing gyms and stuff, the structure in, you know, in how boxing is taught, I know how you would agree with that too. It's not the same as a jiu-jitsu class. I mean, it's not, they don't teach it classroom style. Usually boxing is teaching, you know, kind of one-on-one with the coach, and myself trying to, you know, seek boxing skills, I would go to, you know, a couple boxing gyms, and pretty much when you would pay, it's, you know, if you weren't paying someone right there to hold mitts for you, they just let you go and kind of do your thing. You kind of go to pay work on the bag and stuff. And there wasn't really any formal class where, you know, you get together and you do everything in form together and stuff, like, you know.
Yeah, no, and that's one of the things that I, so when I first started out as a coach, one of my first recreational jobs was at the university doing a, you know, just like an after school program, not even after school, at the university, so like a rec program.
Right.
And so the administrator said, you know, you might get 10, 12 people. I'm like, okay, good. And I'm new at this, right? So I walk in, and every week there was 60 people there. So I had to take what I experienced in boxing, which is similar to you, that it's a lot of one-on-one, and immediately I had to figure out how to handle 60 people. And so that helps me now, because now I can manage a room of 20 people doing all different things, and it does have that, it does have a much more group feeling to it, and more people can learn from it. And it's a good thing that way.
Yeah. So you've been doing that a long time then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll be 40 in March. And so I've been doing it for half my life.
Broken noses?
Yeah, well, you know what? It's cartilage from here down. So you just crack it around. Yeah,
you guys can't see it, man, but he just smashed his nose in his face.
Yeah. And I've been lots of black eyes, fat lips. Yeah.
You know, and I've been boxing with Chad since 2005.
You stay pretty active. You still boxing, Howard?
Oh, I box, I wrestle, and I do jiu-jitsu.
Every day?
every day at four different gyms.
Wow. That's a good life.
Hey, can I plug them?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sure, okay. Monday and Fridays, I'm training with Sean Williams over at Five Star Martial Arts over in the Wilshire area. Sean Williams is a Hanzo Gracie black belt, and he was also part of George St. Pierre's team on The Ultimate Fighter.
Okay.
So he's a legit guy.
Legit dude, yeah.
And then Tuesday and Thursdays, I train with a former Machado student named Glenn Chang, and he's got a jiu-jitsu studio called Let's Roll.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out to my buddy Gabriel who trained.
Hey, Gabe.
Keep your hat on, dude.
And then on Saturdays, I train with... over at R1, you know, that's my spiritual home, because I've been there since 2000, and they basically taught me everything that I know about the combat arts. And then, And then I teach at my own gym, Strong Sports Mixed Martial Arts, Wednesdays and Saturdays. And we're located at 714 North Figueroa Street, just up the street from here.
Oh, just down the block.
Just down the block.
Should go there after one of our sessions here.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, you know, it's a small mixed martial arts gym.
Oh, okay.
So I stay busy.
You do stay busy.
Yeah.
You find it kind of odd. Obviously, I don't want to say you're old, but the older you get, it seems like more of the crowd is younger. And you get to a certain point, like, at least I feel sometimes I'm never like, wow, I'm gonna prove myself to this 18-year-old kid.
No, I'm beyond that. You know, I'm beyond that. Well, you know, I'm gonna be 59 years old.
Wow.
In March. So.
That ain't a thing. That's not even a century.
So, you know, yeah, so I'm always with guys 40 years younger than me. So, you know.
I guess they keep you young, huh?
They keep me young at heart. They really do. I do have my limits. I can't train as hard as they can train because, you know, I'll be a broken body. But if I go at a pretty mellow pace, I can survive the week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably you're in pretty good shape, right?
I hope so.
Yeah. Right. I would think all the stress from like either punching and jujitsu and all that stuff probably helped the bones stay strong too.
Well, you know, one thing I was taught was to be a matador and not a bull in the china shop. So when I'm playing jiu-jitsu, you know how guys have these death grips on the gis?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I don't grab the gi.
You don't?
No. You know, I'll use underhooks, overhooks.
Yeah.
You know.
So kind of more modeling like a no-gi type of approach.
With the jacket on, yeah.
And it saves your grips. I know, you know, even my grips are just all, you know, fingers always in pain from the grips
right.
And stuff like that.
Yeah.
So that's a smart way to do it.
And then in that way, if you decide to take the jacket off and then train no-gi, then there's an easy transition. Because guys, I think who you wrestled, right, Chris?
Yeah, I wrestled. Yeah.
Now, when you went against guys that are doing jiu-jitsu who never wrestled before, but and all they did was wear the jiu-jitsu jacket. Now, the moment that they took off the jacket and started going with you no-gi, did you notice they were grabbing at air?
I think a lot of the people didn't understand the concept of the gi, right?
Yeah, so right.
They don't know where to grab.
Yeah.
I mean, I always said the difference between a wrestler and a jiu-jitsu guy is, I mean, a wrestler, when you wrestle, we're on a grind for 6 minutes.
Exactly.
There's no this relaxing on your back. I mean, you're just constantly grinding.
Yeah.
But we had this discussion a few episodes ago where we talked about gi and no gi.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do your gi game right, your no gi game's a lot better because instead of grabbing a sleeve, you grab a wrist.
Right.
Instead of grabbing a lapel, you underhook.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
So the concept is still there, but mentally you got to make that transition. Okay, so I can't grab a lapel.
Yeah.
So I'm going to underhook, right? Because that's where the control factor
is.
Right,
exactly.
But so, I mean, I think the biggest thing as a wrestler is just that you're always grinding.
Right. And you know, I wrestle too. I've been wrestling since 2000. And so I've kind of like put that as part of the jiu-jitsu game where it's like you said, you know, you got to grind, you have to use certain holds, you know, because you really can't grab.
Right.
And so, you know, that's how I play my jiu-jitsu. I'm actually wrestling in a jiu-jitsu gi is what I'm doing.
Yeah. I think like the older I get and the more I train, I always just like to kind of do what you do. Just kind of flow through the movements. You're
exactly.
Not pressing as hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I can death grip anybody to death with my grip. You know, I can grab people's lapels and they try to rip them and they can't. You
right.
Know? But
yeah, well, this guy had like a lapel he cut off an ogini and like does pull-ups and stuff.
Yeah.
Gorilla grip.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I cut my old gi lapels off and I use them to do pull-ups.
Nice.
Well, it makes your hands simulate grabbing a gi, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah. And when you do a pull-up, you don't grab a belt
right.
like this, right?
Right.
So, I mean.
Yeah.
And I mean, I like my gi, you know, grips myself personally. Mm-hmm. I mean, because for me, a lot of times, you know, I go against guys that are bigger and stuff, and I'm not going to overpower and, you know, and try to rip, you know, for, you know, guys' arms for like kimuras and
roundbar
stuff. So I like my gi choke. I like to work my chokes and, you know. I can work them at my pace and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah.
But definitely my no-gi is different. I do a lot of things I don't do with the gi on and stuff.
Right.
And it forces me to get out of my comfort zone.
Yeah, that's okay though. But you know, but main thing for me is because, you know, at my age, you know, arthritis is right around the corner. So I think the grabbing their life on the gi is really going to be bad for my hand. So, yeah. so I just adjusted it by just doing overhooks and underhooks. Just like you, Craig.
Yeah, a lot of butterfly stuff you can do from there. Yeah. I mean, there's tons of stuff if you're always pressing, you open.
Yeah.
And Chad, do you grapple as well?
Not at all.
No.
No.
No. It says like, right here on this card, BoxingScienceUSA.com.
Yeah.
Complete boxing education.
Yeah. Well, you know, boxing's fantastic. You know, it really is. You know, they call it the sweet science, right? And man, it is a thing of beauty. You know. Chad's been teaching me stuff that I never knew existed.
What is your stance on sparring, Chad? Because I know, like, in different sports, jiu-jitsu, you can train, you know, full on 100% and you're not worried about hurting your partner. With boxing, I know you got to kind of hold back a little in sparring and stuff. And you get the full benefit, though, you know, with those, like, lighter sparring sessions?
Yeah, well, there's different ways to break down the sparring. You know, that's where like a lot of old school gyms might, you know, just let everyone open spar and then see which kid survives, and I'm going to teach them. But really, there's a technical sparring where it could be just jabs, or there's so many situations in a match that you can pick it apart and figure out which kind of situation you're going to add to sparring and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I mean, you can make it really light. There's lots of games too. Again, because I come from Canada where we're European based a lot with our training. And so there's plenty of games you can play without endangering the brain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like break it down. I mean, because it is boxing. Like we're talking about taking punches to the head. But there's three elements to boxing. There's feet, hands, and head. So I can train a lot of feet and hands without having to do head movement. Like we sometimes play tag to the chest. And because that helps, because I try and teach these kids not to, that they're not trying to like catch or block against the opponent's hand. You're trying to block a target. You know, so you'll see some guys who come out too far,
right,
with their hand from their face when they block a jab, like a goalie coming too far from the net, right?
Okay.
Because they're trying to match your hand. But if they try and block their target, then it doesn't matter if I put their target is their chest and they play a game with tag, or their target is their nose. They got to block the target. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So it's about philosophies and concepts.
And with your website and your new company, what is the big concept behind it? You said you are like training people to become instructors, or is it?
Yeah. Like, so what I realized after like so long of doing this is that I really don't enjoy the personal training of it. You know, like the housewives and lawyers, they pay really well, but it's not pleasurable. What I do enjoy is training trainers how to become trainers. And so that's what I have workshops that I put on once a month, and I'm looking at doing more workshops with it, but we're just starting it out. But I want to educate fitness professionals, dads, uncles, whoever wants to learn boxing, mixed martial arts people who want to learn the biomechanics and how the body moves with it. You know, because it's really all the same. And that's one of the things that I like about the R1 gym is that all forms are fluent, and it really is. Like, doesn't matter what sport it is or combat sport, like, the body wants to move in a certain way, and it's most efficiently when it moves in a certain way. So, there's really not that much of a difference.
So, you're gearing your boxing towards MMA, really, the movements and stuff?
Well, I'm gearing my boxing towards the body. I mean, like, break it down, you know. Because, you know, and I remember when I first started working with MMA athletes, I'd say, you know, you got to keep your elbows in. And they'd be like, oh, no, this is MMA. And so I go to, you know, people that I trusted, and I'd say, well, so what's going on with this? It's like, no. Everything is the same thing. You have your elbows protect your body, your hands protect your face and your throat. Doesn't matter if you're 6 feet, 4 feet, or 2 feet, you're going to do the same pretty much mechanics. And so, I mean, so going along with all forms are fluent, it really doesn't make sense. Like, it's not really that much of a difference. People want to make up that there is a difference, but that's just like ego-based in my mind. It really is so similar.
And, you know, from your experience and stuff in watching the fights, who are some of the fighters you would say today that really adapt and use their boxing well that you can think of currently?
In MMA?
Yeah.
I got to be honest. I'm not a big fan of like names, records. I like to sit down and watch MMA because I think it's potentially such a great sport because there's so many skill sets and it blends, and which athletes have a primary, which ones have a, you know, take it all equally and you know, and blend it really well. Which ones use footwork and ringmanship? Which ones just go straight forward? I mean, like, it's a really great sport to watch, but I really don't have any, I don't watch people for people. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, yeah. Yeah. I get it. Yeah. Well, you sit there and you just, I mean, if you're a boxing guy, you just sit there and critique the boxing aspect regardless of who it is. Like, right, oh, like this guy's got a great technique.
Not really. I mean, like, the R1 gym is, it's a great place to learn this stuff. And so I can watch something and go like with hips. So like, let's say like this, and I know we're on radio, but imagine that, a guy who, and I see it all the time, a guy who throws a punch and he misses and then he reaches for a takedown, but his hips are up in the air. His head's lower than his hips. I mean, like, that's just bad biomechanics. It doesn't matter if it's boxing or it's, you know, because if I can't touch with my punch, I'm not really there for a clean shot. And it, again, it goes back to the elbows because, well, you know, you said that you're a bit of a wrestler, right?
Yeah.
Or you are a wrestler. So, I mean, like, if I'm not close enough to be able to keep my elbows to my body and make that shot happen, it doesn't matter. If I'm reaching away from it, it's still bad form.
Well, it's the same. Well, it's almost like they say the guy's telegraphing a shot.
Right.
It's almost the same when you telegraph a punch, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I get people all the time telling me, like, or I see it, like, on the internet, like, on YouTube, where they throw a left hook, and I've seen people teach this, that, like, you know, you take the shoulder and then go with the hand. But, I mean, if you've ever boxed with a person in front of you who throws their shoulder before their hand, that's a telegraph, and I'll step back, I'll block it. You know what I mean? Like, telegraphs, and again, it goes back to, like, the body wants to move in a certain way.
Well, is that almost why the people use it? You always hear people using the jab as a term as to they're trying to judge a space between them and their opponent. Is that necessarily true?
Well, yeah. I mean, the jab is a huge asset for that. You know, I actually, it's funny that you mentioned that. I had a guy who contacted me about training him. He's like, hey, take a look at a couple of my videos. I said, okay, great. So I looked at his videos, and this is just last week. And I said, you know what? I bet you have a lot of people tell you you have an awesome jab. He's like, yeah. Because it's a nonstop piston, going, right?
Uh-huh.
But he's 6 inches away from his target the whole time. So his range is off, and he's telling his man, like if me and Howard are fighting, I'm telling Howard exactly where the end of my range is. Howard can stay right there and then time it to come in.
Right.
I mean, like, it's so now his good jab that should be an asset is an absolute liability. All he has to do is fix his range, but that's, yeah.
Yeah, that's like I always tell people, that's the equivalent to a clinch in wrestling. Mm-hmm. The reason you clinch in wrestling is so you can judge how much space you got before you take that shot on the legs, right?
Yeah.
People don't realize that. They think they're just up there grunting and grabbing and stuff. But it's really to judge the space between you, your hips, your opponent's hips, and when you're going to take that shot.
Yeah. You know, and I like to call it all, how do you approach the danger zone? Because that's what it really is.
Right.
You know, and it could be in boxing, wrestling, jiu-jitsu, judo, anything. You have to enter that danger zone and you know, there's there proper mechanics and strategy to do it, and you know that's why I box with Chad because he's teaching me that danger zone, and I can apply the same concepts to when I'm playing jiu-jitsu.
Right.
So you know, so here I am learning boxing to get better at jiu-jitsu.
Well, I mean, I think it's all almost what Chad said. It's all kind of the biomechanics are all the same.
Yeah,
it's all relative.
And strategy. I mean, like, if you think about, like, say, even football, all right? Like, do you want to go down the middle all the time or do you want to flank?
Depends.
Well, exactly. No, but for sure.
For sure, yeah.
But I mean, like, how many times do you see a fight, doesn't matter what kind of fight it is, but where the two guys come out, me in the middle. But I mean, like, you as a wrestler or me as a boxer, like, I don't want to just stand there. I want to angle, cut corners.
Yeah.
I mean, that, and then when I get to that corner just before he does, I got my shot right there, whether it's a boxing shot or a wrestling shot.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all the same thing.
Well, I mean, it's all...
They all got their nuances, you know.
Yeah, I understand. I totally understand what you're saying. It's all you...
It's simple if you keep it all, like, they all have the same fundamentals.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially for people that are really like now trying to evolve their game and stuff.
Exactly.
You know, everyone's trying to put the pieces together and you know... And we've said this before too, how back in the way it was in the beginning, where the UFC and you know all MMA events were just style versus style.
It's completely evolved. Yeah.
You know where what was going to be better, boxing or just jiu-jitsu, and now it's a beautiful thing to see all these styles like really meshing and you know everyone's taking the best pieces and just the fundamentals and really you know how they're just drawing off of each other.
Yep.
So how important is nutrition and conditioning and boxing to you, Chad?
Well, nutrition is huge because it's a weight class sport, right? Mm-hmm. So, right. Unless you're a heavyweight, which means you still have to have good nutrition because the body works off of the way I look at it and the way I explain it to people is that the basics is that the body works off of, it's like chemistry. All right. So, and I get to know what my body likes to do with what I'm doing. So, I mean, you could eat a meal and have a glass of orange juice and you have the same meal and have a glass of water, a glass of milk. And those are all different chemicals working in different ways. And your body reacts something different than it does to mine. So, and nutrition is our fuel for the car, right? So, I mean, like, that's a huge component. Even as a personal trainer, I love it that people think that it's got so much to do with conditioning, which it does, but nutrition is so huge.
Yeah.
Yeah, in energy and everything. You don't.
Oh, for
you
sure.
You don't gas up the car and put it in the garage.
Yep, I remember.
What?
You don't fill the car and just, you know.
I do because gas is like liquid gold now.
Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah. I filled that car up when it was $2.50 a gallon.
Yeah. I remember I had an athlete once who was like, I told him, I said, okay, I want you to eat more meat and some vegetables. He's like, okay, good. So the next day he comes in, he's like, oh, I'm feeling sluggish. I'm like, well, what did you eat today? He's like, oh, no, I had my meat, my vegetables. I'm like, really, how? He's like, and pot pie. I'm like,
you should have been more specific.
Kind of diet. Exactly. It really is, man. Sounds like what I eat.
And he probably got 5 cents back from the tin. But, you know, like, even when I used to wrestle, like, I used to tell people, it's 90% diet. Mm-hmm. Right, like we used to cut weight. It's 90% diet because you can lose weight just by watching your diet. Yeah. You don't have to work out. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, obviously,
right?
But we used to say, "Hey, 90% of it's diet," and most people can't commit enough of their time for that diet part.
Yeah,
you can run all day. You can, you know, you can do sled pulls and climb up a hill backwards. And but if you can't watch your diet, you ain't cutting weight,
right? Yeah. You know, there's a psychology saying that I really like called small things, all things. So the way someone does the small things, the way they do all things. So me as a coach, if that athlete is like, you know, screw diet until the very last little bit, and they want to try and cut weight and do all this stuff, that's telling me that that's a guy who wants to try and cut corners on everything. He's not willing to be committed, like you said, committed to the long haul of it.
Right.
And so that's a scary thing because then it's like, what kind of wonder tool does he think he's going to pull out in competition? That's not going to happen.
As Richard and I sip our Rockstar Monster drink, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hey, we got sugar-free, though. We're okay.
Yeah, I start cutting next week, okay?
Yeah. Howard and Chad have water. Rich and I have Rockstar.
It's going to be the thing. We're all going to be training, you know. Next
exactly.
Week.
Hey, no, hey, it's a brotherhood.
It's
know.
A fuel injector good. Cleaner.
Mm. There you go.
They'll be on weight, and I'll be talking about how I need to lose weight.
So you lost how many pounds did you lose?
Over 120 pounds.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's
man.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
It was training, but yes, I do agree. And harder than anything was, yes, it was the diet part of it.
Yeah.
Was, well, you know, I mean, I understood that I needed to work harder and work out. And when I found jiu-jitsu, it was so much fun for me. It wasn't a chore to train. It was, you know, even through the bumps and bruises and injuries, it was all fun for me. So I can say, you know, the weight fell off because I was having a great time training. You know, I fell in love with the sport.
Right.
Same thing. My first day when, you know, this girl half my size smiled at me and triangle choked me and nearly put me to sleep. And I, you know, I knew I was in love with the sport. But yeah,
nice.
I can't agree, you know, more that diet is going to be the biggest part of it.
Yeah.
It's hard to break it down to like really percentages of what, you know, takes precedence because it really does act all together. You know, like once you find something that you love to do, because I mean, if you don't like going to the gym,
right,
that's
going to
be a hard game. Yeah.
Really?
I never, you know, I wasn't the type of person that would go and can, you know, get in the treadmill for, you know, half an hour or be at the gym all day lift. For me, that was boring and it wasn't, you know, I wasn't really into it. You know, I would lose a little bit of weight and then go back on and until I found, you know, my second family at you know, at my academy,
right.
It was, you know, was the best thing that ever happened to me. And you know, I just hope to keep doing as long as I can.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, just like everyone I know, everyone says the same thing too, you know, we want to do this as long as we're physically able.
Well, you know, jiu-jitsu is one of those exercises that you can do, you know, until you're old. You know, because you can, you know, you can go hard, you can go easy, and since you're on the ground already, you know, you don't have to take those risky falls. So it's something that you can do for a real long time. Hmm. Was it Halo Gracie, was still doing jiu-jitsu,
into his 90s.
Yeah.
Wow.
See, and, you know, and I hope, you know, and I hope he'd be doing it
till I'm a really old man. You know, I'm old now, but you know, I hope they're doing this till I'm 90.
Yeah.
You know?
How about the boxing?
Till I'm 90 too.
Yeah.
Also.
The way I teach it, he could do it till he's 90.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, I am really blessed. I'm really lucky to have coaches like Chad and Rico Ciparelli from the R1. They really break this down into a pure science. You know, everything is biomechanically correct.
Right.
You know, I don't have any weird injuries because I'm always in the right position. You know, I have the right footwork. You know, I have the right hip movement, and it's all because of these guys. And you know, they have very, 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 very high standards.
And do you still are you still now these days a big MMA fan? Do you watch the fights
all the time, man? Huge fan.
So what happened with the? Sorry, dude. I was just gonna say, since we're on the MMA, what happened with the short sponsorship of Randy Couture? How did that happen?
It was with Rico Ciparelli. He introduced me to Randy, and this is when he after he defeated Vitor Belfort, and then he went to Japan to fight. And then he came back. When he came back, he was hooked up with me, and so I was his short sponsor, and I was also the sponsor of quite a few other guys that were part of the Raw team. I was Matt Lindland's original sponsor.
Okay.
Dan Henderson's original sponsor.
Oh, little Hendo.
Yeah, okay. Vladimir Matyshenko's sponsor, Frank Trigg's sponsor, and also Tom Erickson's sponsor. Those guys. And I had a bunch of guys that I sponsored in Japan. I sponsored Ensign Inoue.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that guy.
Wasn't he from Pride?
Huh? Yeah, he found Pride. I was Rico Rodriguez's sponsor. Remember him?
Oh, yeah.
They used to tell me I used to look like him when I was like 40 pounds heavier.
No, great guy.
I think I saw him, what was it, about a year ago. Actually, he was at Grappler's Quest in Vegas.
And now, I understand he's down to 205 pounds.
He looked leaner. He looked good, and he did win that division.
Great. He's a good guy. Yeah. Great athlete, I think.
Yeah. Shout out to Grappler's Quest. That's always a fun tournament to do. Brian's always
Brian Simmons. Yeah.
He's always a great host, and you know, to all of our teammates when we're down there and stuff. You know, working with him.
Yeah. You know, this is interesting. I was talking with Egan Inoue. He's Anson's brother. Okay. And actually, my black belt lineage actually goes back to Egan Inoue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I got my black belt from Andy Wang.
Okay.
Who got his black belt from Barrett Yoshida.
Oh, okay.
And who got his black belt from Egan Inoue.
Wow.
And Egan got his black belt from Andre Pedernales and John Lewis.
Wow.
Okay. So, you know, he was at my shop yesterday. We were talking, and we were talking about the old days, and he goes, yeah, he goes, I remember when Dana White was just a manager for Chuck Liddell and Tito Ortiz. And I said, yeah. I said, you know, Egan, did you know that the Dana White and the Fertitta brothers, actually, when they started doing jiu-jitsu, they were wearing my gis?
They did, huh?
Yeah.
You got pictures of that? That's pretty cool.
I have the original sales receipt.
Even better.
Proof.
No, they were training in Vegas with John Lewis. I don't know if you guys know who John Lewis is.
Why does his name sound so familiar?
Okay, John Lewis had a jiu-jitsu academy named called J-Sect, and his big guys were BJ Penn.
Okay.
And a future.
I think I know that guy.
And a future great, Robert Drysdale.
Oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
When he was a little white belt.
So before Team Brasa then?
When he was a little kid, when he was 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I've known John from way back when, and he was teaching jiu-jitsu to Dana White and to Lorenzo and Frank Fertitta. And he gave me a call one day and said, hey, can you sell some geese to these guys? And I was, you know, at that time, I didn't know who they were.
And that was in Vegas, is it?
Yeah, they were in Vegas. You know.
Oh, okay. Because I know, yeah, Robert went, he came from Brazil when he was probably about that age, wasn't it?
No. He's an American born.
Oh, was it? I know he spent some time. He did live in Brazil for a while.
Yeah, no. He is Brazilian, but I think he was born here in America, and then
he went to Brazil. I have met.
He's an expat. I guess you would call it that.
I met Robert a couple of times.
Nice
stand-up guy, very nice guy. We were there actually when he opened his gym in Vegas a couple years ago.
Yeah,
and it was just barely about a couple of days before it opened. And he had a black belt actually fly in from New York to take some privates with him.
Nice.
Yeah, but you go there and he treats you like he knows you.
Yeah, very, very nice guy.
Real.
Stop by his place in Vegas and no problem.
Good kid.
Yeah. Have you seen the sport? So have you seen the sport change a lot then? Jiu-jitsu in the last 10, 15 years?
Yeah, it's changed, I think, a little bit. I think the people coming into this sport now have a lot more knowledge than when I was training. Like if you're a white belt, when I was training, you didn't know anything, right?
Right.
Now, if you come in as just a walk-in white belt, you know, with the information available on the internet now, I mean, everybody knows a little bit about what's going on.
Everything, right?
Seems like it.
I know before, or, you know, back in the days, you weren't allowed to, like, videotape seminars and stuff.
Exactly.
But now it's like everyone's videotaping them, so you can take that information back.
Yeah. And then we got guys like you that they're coming in from the wrestling background that's bringing a much-needed aspect to the sport, you know.
Well, I always tell people it's when I got started. Like, I think when you finish wrestling college, you're either wrestling coach or you went to teach wrestling at a high school.
Right.
But other than that, you had no options, right?
Yeah.
And so you can call up your buddy and be like, "Hey, dude, you want to go wrestle?" Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So it was just a good transitional sport for me, but obviously. You take some of the dynamics of wrestling and put them in jiu-jitsu.
I used to
get guillotined all the time until I figured out where to put my head.
Yeah.
You still get beat up, and it's just a trend. You know, you got to figure out how the movements go together.
But because you're a wrestler, you probably picked it up in like 6 months.
Yeah,
like,
pretty
boom,
quick.
Like that, it's quick.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, grappling is second nature to you.
It's good now. I think it's great for all the wrestlers out there because you get these kids that go, you go to some of the Midwest states and they wrestle their whole lives.
Oh, yeah.
And now they got plenty of options, right?
Yeah.
You got gyms sprouting up everywhere.
Yeah. It definitely changes the games for like guys like me that didn't have any type of background starting in the sport. You know, this is my first sport for me. So, training with guys like Crail and other people that come wrestling, it definitely has changed our game. And just even changing the way you see things at tournaments.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, higher percentage takedowns a lot more, you know, things that are just complementing our sport.
Right. Well, you know, I always said, you know, wrestling and jiu-jitsu is like peanut butter and jelly. You know, both are good separately, but boy, when you put them together, man, it's a delicious sandwich.
I like that.
You know, and what I think was really great about the evolution of jiu-jitsu too is that it's actually made awareness of the other combat arts too. I think judo got revived.
Yes.
And I think, well, you look at Chad's here in LA teaching boxing. You know, and you know, boxing is well, first of all, back in the day, it's like, here, you know, where do you find boxing?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to find. And then when you do find it, it's in areas that you don't want to be in.
Yeah.
But I think because of the way how jiu-jitsu evolved and its connection to mixed martial arts, I think it's opened up, a lot of other avenues for the other combat arts. You know, guys like Chad can come in here and, can teach boxing or he can teach in instructors to teach boxing. And I think it all starts because of the movement that jiu-jitsu brought into today's sport.
It opened the door for him to come, you know, train these grapplers. But, you know, Chad is, you know, that's a really good thing for you too, because I see how passionate you are about teaching and you training all these instructors. I mean, it only shows that, you know, you're going to reach so many more people, at least your style is, by teaching all these
instructors. Most definitely. I mean, I read a saying a couple months ago, something about a true leader isn't measured by the followers, it's by how many leaders they create. And so, I mean, and that's kind of where I'm going with it, that I truly do believe that combat arts in general are great for kids. Discipline, commitment, all kinds of stuff. And it's individual. What I like about combat arts is that it's one-on-one. So I get to take personal responsibility for what I do in the competition area, but it's in a team environment. So, and that's what a lot of kids get to have. And if it wasn't for jiu-jitsu to come in and really take a grip of, no pun intended, but take a grip on, you know, and develop MMA, then it wouldn't be for, you know, the combat arts being so socially acceptable now.
Right. It definitely opened a lot of doors. I mean, especially, you know, UFC 1, you know, just watching Hoist just choke everybody out, just revived, you know, every sport involved. And even, you know, just a couple years ago, even looking at Machida, now all of a sudden, you know, karate is becoming relevant again.
Funny thing about Lyoto Machida, you know, I used to train with him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He came to the R1 gym back in 2002.
Just tell us you showed him that switch kick.
No. No, he was amazing, man. He's an amazing dude. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He seems like a good guy.
Really good guy. Really good guy. Yeah.
Yeah, so that is great how, you know, yeah, it's true. All of these styles are being, brought up again, and we're getting to see everyone, get excited about it. But, like you were saying, jiu-jitsu and wrestling, peanut butter and jelly. It's
absolutely
true. And one of the things I like so much about wrestling is it seems like wrestling instills a work ethic in people
that
is
so true.
Second to none.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's just, just a mental toughness and just, it's one of those things that I encourage people that, if they have like children, they want to get involved in sports, at least start them off in wrestling because it builds such a strong base for them to move into other martial arts.
Well, I think it kind of also correlates with what Chad's saying, where you build that mental toughness, even in boxing, right?
Mm-hmm. But something that I've really learned to appreciate with wrestling is the area that it allows, the environment it allows a child to come in and learn how to adapt to courage. Because with boxing, if it's too hot, I step back, circle around a little bit, take a breath, get back into it. You don't do that with wrestling. It's just action, 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 action. And so, that's a good thing for a child to know, or a young man or a young person, to know, is like how to step into the fire. Because the way I look at combat sports is that person is learning how to deal with adversity. So they're not really with an opponent. It's like, how are they going to deal with adversity? Are they going to run away, cry for their mom? Are they going to come straight at it? And with wrestling, it teaches you, their angles, action after reaction after reaction.
Yeah, you find that, where people are great in the gym and then, they get to tournament and, they break. They don't even know what's going on and stuff.
Well, we talked earlier about like nutrition, conditioning, skills, but mental preparation is huge. Huge.
Mm-hmm. How do you mentally prep for that, though? I mean, like I would say, let's say a tournament, the only way to prep for that is to actually be in tournaments, right? Mm-hmm. But then some people always get anxiety. I tell people, I mean, one year, I must have wrestled 400 matches in the year because I used to do all my league wrestling.
Right.
And then after league, I used to do freestyle wrestling.
Right.
Right. And, and so I wrestled all year. I don't think I had any months off.
I'm curious at what ages?
This was probably in high school, right? But when I used to do freestyle, it was no ages. It was just weight class. So okay. I always remember I went to Golden West College for a freestyle tournament and the guy I went up to was like 35. I'm like 16.
Is that why you're rocking the mustache and you're like 12?
No, dude. I tell you, dude, you're born with a mustache in the hood.
All right.
But I used to go to these freestyle tournaments. Right, it's no ages. It was just weight, right? So like this guy was like 35, just beat me up, right? Yeah. But
right there though, so mentally preparation, that has a lot to do with a coach, because you had a lot of opportunity there to mentally prepare for where to go with it. Your mental preparation is just like your conditioning. You have to peak at a certain time. If you just go out there randomly going like, I'm gonna give it hard every competition I'm in, whether it's that 35-year-old or this or the championship, then you don't know how to control your mental peak. There's times where you get to go into like exhibition matches where you get to play with stuff, experiment, learn, lose, whatever. It's just, did you accomplish the skill sets that you're looking for? And then take that mental preparation into like in boxing. I remember a coach told me a long time ago was that like some of our national champions in Canada were like a huge gap in wins and losses. It's like, yeah, but they win the nationals every time, because it doesn't matter what they win or lose on the other ones, as long as they're learning. And then they pull it out for the big ones. It's mental preparation.
Yeah, but I still think there's people out there who still get nervous regardless. I get nervous now.
Sure. But nerves is, I love it when I ask an athlete before a competition, like, how you feeling? You a little nervous? Oh, no, man, I got this. That makes me scared because I'm like, no way. Because nerves are, it's a fear. And if you learn how to tap into that fear, it's like fight or flight, caveman, a saber-toothed tiger's coming up on him. He's either going to grab a stick and fight, or he's going to run up that tree. He's going to fight or flight. So which way am I going to take that and apply it?
I would take the science approach and be like, yeah, saber-toothed tigers are extinct.
without that fear, you don't know if you're really even, aware of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And
small things, all things. So again, if my competition season is random, doesn't know where I'm going with it, I'm just going to play hard the whole time, was the same thing as like my mental prep is that, if I have, you know, I lost it. I rebooted. Sorry, guys.
That's all right. The only reason I bring it up is because sometimes I come across people and they're like, man, I've done like 400. I'm not worried about this one, right?
Yeah.
But I sit there and I don't know if I get nervous just because you've done so much work and I just hate to lose, you know? Mm-hmm.
But that's awesome.
Sometimes.
Well.
But I sit there and I mean, I like, even though like at the end of the day, and I've had a lot of people tell me, and it's good advice, because look, and if you take a step back, all the greats have lost. You watch a championship bout, someone's going to lose.
Sure.
Right? But it doesn't make them. But yeah, I sit there and I go like, man, I hate to lose, right?
So, but it's good though, you know, because I have a lecture for almost everything, right? Uh-huh. And so my lecture for that goes like this, is that as an athlete, like as a coach looking at an athlete, it's like that's your job to hold the bar high for yourself. I would rather have an athlete where I got to pull the chain back and go like, hold on, son, just wait a minute, than I would have that guy that's sitting on the bench be like, oh, come on, get off. Go play, go work. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you go ahead, you keep on having that high bar for yourself. Let me come in and go like, okay, take a deep breath, relax. What did you learn from this? Because there's always a learning experience.
Right.
What did you do well? We do this in the gym all the time. Almost after every sparring, we talk to each other as sparring mates and go, what did I do well and what do I need to work on? And so it's the same thing. So even off the losses, there's something you can learn from. And the day of a loss or the day of a competition, doesn't matter if it's a win or a loss, is like let you have whatever emotion you're having as an athlete and then come back with a sound, neutral mind for a debriefing the next day. You know what I mean? Like there's ways to deal with it as a coach. You're an athlete. You're supposed to go. It's my job as a coach to pull the reins up, to control the pace of you.
Yeah. I mean, even in class, like I'll go home after training and I'll be looking at videos like, man, I need to incorporate this, or I should have done this, or I actually did a move and I'm like, man, I got to incorporate that.
See, he's got the crack.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm like, I'll crack that in my house.
That's good though, man. That is great.
Dude, I got all kinds of videos.
Those are those things, even like, you know, when we're cooling down, we're closing out our class, our coaches always tell you, know, think about what you did well today.
Yeah.
Think about, think about the mistakes you made and think about the things you did
well.
That's
good coach.
Yeah, good coach.
Sure. And, you know, and even he always brings it up. He goes, well, you know what, too, in training, if you're not getting tapped out, you're not training hard enough.
Oh, yeah, you're not challenging yourself.
Yeah.
And it's good. I bet you know guys in the gym that are like that, who always want to go with the guys who are a little bit lower because they got a little bit of bullying them. They want to stay on top the whole time. They're not willing to.
Yeah, they're not willing to challenge themselves.
Right.
Yeah. You don't get better that way.
Or do something. I always tell people, like, I always put myself in positions that I'm not comfortable in.
Right.
Because if that ever does happen to me, I've been there. Right.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Especially jiu-jitsu, you know.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
you got top players and bottom players. Right. I mean, I can smash somebody for 8-10 minutes all day long.
Right.
But is that going to benefit me any? No.
No.
Right.
Yeah, no, because they put you on your back for those 2 minutes. How do you deal with that?
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. That's really where you learn, when you put yourself in a situation you're not comfortable with and learn from it. But
yeah,
and that's the thing, at a high level, let's say you're going into a championship match, your spar mates aren't going to be at the same high level, so you have to put yourself into those new kind of situations. So even if a new situation that you've never experienced comes up, you still know how mentally to go, mentally and emotionally. It's important to go, oh, you know what, I've been in numerous new situations,
right?
This is just a new situation for me to handle. And so it's experience.
I mean, I'm always a bundle of nerds before tournament, but the only thing that really isn't the thing that affects me much is what's going to happen, you know, to me. I always figure, what, you know, this person I'm going against cannot do anything worse than my own training partners do to me in class. So I'm not worried about my
opponent.
That's
a good mindset,
You know, I've already, you know, just tried to do my work diligently, you know, in my gym and just, you know, just go, you know, but there's still always a big, you know, amount of like, you know.
You know, it's fortunate that you train at a place that has that high level. You can be that confident because of your training mates. And some people who are maybe listening who don't have that, who are the top dogs in their pound, then they get to challenge themselves on skills. You know, like let someone else go with all punches.
Yeah.
All moves. I don't know. And then, you know, but they only keep like just jab or whatever. They get to challenge themselves in a certain way.
I also think part of that mental toughness is like when you have a move and you know it, you let the other guy know, okay, like, hey, you got to, I guess what I'm saying is you also have to help teach the people you're rolling with.
Sure.
Because that makes everybody better.
Right.
Because next time you roll with that person, you don't get them in that triangle that easy. They know how to fight it. Now it makes you have to work for something else.
Exactly.
Right.
And don't be ashamed to ask somebody. If you know somebody that, you know, has a good position that they're well at, you know, There's never, you know, any wrong in asking, you know, someone for help and stuff too. Yeah, even if they're lower,
all the time,
yeah. Even if they're like a lower belt level or something, you know.
Everybody has something to offer, I think.
Oh yeah, and I've heard black belts say, you know, I learn things from white belts all the time, you know.
Well, you know, one thing those I always say, you know, the belt is just a piece of cloth that covers your waistband, right? Because what you're stepping on the mat really tells you exactly where you're at.
Yeah.
And you know, and the mat never lies.
Right.
The boxing ring never lies.
Yeah.
You know.
Right. The results and everything, you know.
It's right there.
It's on paper. Medals don't lie, and, you know.
Yeah, it's right there, you know. Yeah.
That's so true.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
That's so true. So, you got anything else, girl?
Well, before we just wrap up, I know we went a little bit over, but it's excellent because I think you guys have a lot of good stuff. I wish we could sit here for another hour or two and talk to you guys because there's so much stuff that I think the people would like to hear. But before we go, maybe we can just get some quick plugs for you guys. Maybe Howard, thank you for coming by. Thank maybe you can tell you. Everybody where they can get your information or
where can someone go to take a look at your kimonos or
okay, it's
buy one.
Sure. Okay, it's very simple. It's howardlu.com. That's howardlu.com.
Okay.
And Chad?
Yeah, so we actually do workshops. And so we have another workshop coming up at the end of the month. I believe it's February 26th. It's in Marina Del Rey. All the information can be found on boxingscienceusa.com. And you can register at, you can call me at the phone number 310-946-2267 or email info@boxingscienceusa. And it's a, I think I dubbed it, what did I put there on the flyer?
I see a 109fitness.com also.
Yeah. That's the host of the show of the event, the workshop. And it's for fighters, fans, and fitness professionals. I really want to get out boxing and combat sports to the community level. And so it's an 8-hour day. You can come in for the first 4 hours, and it's a lot of doing. You're going to learn the biomechanics of the basic punches. You're going to do a little bit of fitness workouts. You're going to learn how to teach boxing and do boxing with minimal amount of equipment, because it is possible. And then if you come back after lunch, you're going to learn the biomechanics of how to teach sports.
Excellent.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, you know, make sure and check out those websites. And if you're in the area and if you can attend a workshop, you want to work on your boxing skills or you're in the market for a new gi, you know where to find it.
Yeah. Hey, and then real quick before we go, I just want to give a quick shout out to our buddies over at Paul Silva Jiu-Jitsu out in San Diego. My buddy Brandon out there listening in. He had some guys competing at that Grappling X tournament.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And also a shout out to
that's my purple belt brother from another mother, Brandon out there.
And shout out to everyone that competed today at the New Breed Academy in-house tournament. It was a great turnout today. It was a really good showing of good sportsmanship and everyone having a great time. And that's exactly what our sport is all about. And hope to see everyone soon back on the mat.
Yeah, and we'll try to get some links or information up so you can get a hold of Chad or some direct links to
check out our Facebook page.
Go buy a gi from Howard.
Check out our Facebook page. Check out our Twitter. We will be putting out that information. Everyone out there, you know, support the people that support our show. We appreciate you all. We do this for you. And, next weekend, don't forget to check us out at Proving Grounds. If you haven't got your tickets, make sure you go to the Fight Academy Pasadena website and get your tickets and come hang out with us at the show and come check us out at the Fight Me clothing booth.
Yeah.
All right. Until next week, we'll see you next time.
Crail out.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much. Yep.
Yeah. Hey.